Con el under $3 menu de McDonald's, un McChicken es solo $1.50. Resulta que ser el héroe de tu primita solo te cuesta $1.50. Por un McChicken, good deal. Solo por tiempo limitado. Precios y participación pueden variar. Precios con entrega pueden ser más altos.
In recent years, the St. Louis Cardinals have made themselves into Major League Baseball's model franchise. Since the turn of the century, the Redbirds have reached the postseason 12 times, won 4 pennants, and 2 World Series titles, most recently in 2011, and previously in 2006.
For the first time since 1982, St. Louis has a World Series winner.
This continues a legacy that includes 11 championships, a mark that no other National League team can match. Howard Megdahl's newest book, The Cardinals' Way, examines how St. Louis has melded new wave ideals while maintaining an old school approach. But the Cardinals' sterling reputation was tarnished recently when a team executive, Christopher Correa, pled guilty in January to hacking into a database and email system of the Houston Astros in order to steal closely guarded information about their players. So I started by asking Howard how severely he thinks the Cardinals' clean-cut image has been affected by this latest development.
Well, you know, I think there's two parts to it. There's the short term and the long term. In the short term, it was obviously a tough hit to take. There's no question about it. But I think as we get further and further from it, it's really notable in my mind that you saw a single person ultimately was involved with this. And I say that not just in terms of the Cardinals' own internal investigation, but the fact that as the Cardinals were conducting that internal investigation, you had the FBI looking over their shoulder as well. So even if you had any questions about their own conclusions, the fact that the FBI came to a similar conclusion, and my understanding is that the investigation is over with Correa's guilty plea, I think that's very telling about, you know, whether this is in any way systemic. I think pretty clearly it is not. And so ultimately in time, I think you see MLB hand down a punishment of some kind. And frankly, with, you know, 100-year history, seems like it'll end up being something larger than a footnote, to be sure, but something smaller than a trajectory-changing moment for them.
Now, I'm assuming you were at the end, the very end of completing this book when the news first broke of the FBI and the Justice Department investigating this last summer. Did you happen to get a kind of almost like a better sense of how some around the organization felt about this matter as opposed to other reporters?
Well, I can't speak to other reporters. I can tell you for me specifically how it ended up going down was I was at the end. I had submitted a final manuscript, and so I was fortunate enough that it happened in enough time that I could go back and re-report. And, you know, the Cardinals and also members of the Astros, like Jeff Lunau, Sid Metzdahl, you know, the people who were involved with the analytic revamp of the Cardinals in the early part of the 2000s, they were all so generous with their time anyway. That from, you know, Bill DeWitt and Mo on down on the Cardinals side as well, everyone was able to go back through and we were able to have conversations and sort of figure out where things were within the confines of that particular moment. So we were able to re-report it out and make sure there was a full accounting of it in the book as well.
The basis of your book and the method of operation began really even at the height of their success. Owner Bill DeWitt made the choice to reinvent and get the club more involved with analytics. How did this transition sit with other luminaries within the organization, especially Tony La Russa, the manager from 96 through 2011, and a guy that I've pretty much read dismissed the Moneyball ideal?
Yeah, Tony was not on board really for any part of it at any moment. There was a real nice moment, though, in the 2011 playoffs, where Tony approached Jeff Lunau and said something along the lines of, if I had known you were going to send me a whole bunch of guys who could throw 95 plus, I'd have been on board for your analytic rebuild ago, you know, and so there was an ultimate appreciation, I feel like, that at least what had been done ended up working. But that was the big challenge. This was not just bringing analytics into a group that, let's say, wasn't familiar with it. This was bringing analytics into the St. Louis Cardinals, a team that had done things as traditionally as anyone in baseball, number one, but number two, had been winning with them recently with the methods they had been using. And so, to me, what's so fascinating about this is, when you go back and you look at Moneyball, the Oakland A's were in a dead end. They had come up against the limitations of what they were doing, and it wasn't working, and so a change was necessary. What Bill DeWitt did, bringing in Jeff Lunau, it's so fascinating to me, is he, into the teeth of a winning period of time, because remember the Cardinals, were in the playoffs in 2000, right there in the playoff chase and making the playoffs several times between 2000 and 2006, and the Cardinals made the decision to go in a different direction anyway, even to the consternation of their own general manager, Walt Jocketty. And so that makes for a fascinating and difficult change, and the difficulties maintained really throughout Jeff Lunau's time with the Cardinals from 2003 to 2011.
As we mentioned at the start, the Cardinals have adapted to this change while still holding on to that tradition. We remember this was the first franchise to utilize the farm system under the direction of Branch Rickey, and the team has upheld its importance through these years to a great degree. When it comes to player development, specifically at the minor league level, what are the most significant criteria for drafting and acquiring talent?
So that really varies from year to year. There's an interesting combination. The Cardinals, through the analytic revamp, were able to put together essentially one value number, ultimately, a system that allows scouting and analytics to merge in a draft list. And there's some deviation from it, but it's, for the most part, a way that allows them to use the information to guide them the way they want to be guided, which is to say their scouting needs to play a significant part and the numbers need to play a significant part as well. But where their tradition has really held up over this long period of time is the way in which players are developed once the Cardinals draft them. And that is something that hasn't changed in a fundamental way going back to the very beginnings of the farm system itself. As you mentioned, Branch Rickey created the farm system, and he did so with the St. Louis Cardinals. Well, Branch Rickey hired in 1940, signed actually a young kid out of upstate New York, a guy named George Tissell, who went on to be player coach, and then coach in the Cardinals minor league system for 68 years, from 1940 to 2008. So in Tissell, you have this through line of very specific development that not only has to do with the very beginnings of when the Cardinals excelled at this, but goes right through into and includes the training of players who are helping the Cardinals now. It's sort of an amazing thing. A guy entered the Cardinals organization before Stan Musial played a game in St. Louis and was also a big part of someone like Matt Carpenter's development. It's just sort of a fascinating thing to see.
Going back to what you mentioned about Moneyball, that those are the new school methods the Cardinals have utilized, or where it comes straight from. As you said, a process made famous by Billy Beane in Oakland, and this has taken form in many ways where the Cardinals are, I don't want to say reluctant, but they're not going to make the major investment when it comes to long-term, high-priced contracts. We saw that this very offseason with Jason Hayward departing to the rival Cubs after one very good season in St. Louis. And most prominently, we saw it with Albert Pujols, the face of the franchise for the better part of a decade. Once his contract was up after 2011, he chose to sign a 10-year, $240 million deal with the Angels. And I think the Cardinals offered him a similar contract, maybe like $30 million less, but probably could have matched it. What the Angels had offered, and he would have stayed. It turned out to be, I guess, in the long run, a wise move. Pujols was, now in his mid-30s, was 31, I think, then. Isn't the same superstar player he was in St. Louis. The Cardinals probably would have been signing him for who he was more than what he could have been. Was that a difficult transition for the club, having to depart with a player who was so beloved by the fans?
It was, and I will just say, I would take somewhat of an issue with the idea that the Cardinals won't go long-term for players, not only in terms of keeping their own guys long-term, if you look at, you know, they recently did that with Matt Carpenter, but also, you know, bringing in a guy like Matt Holliday, you know, let him play here for a year and a half in St. Louis, and then went 7 years, $120 million to keep him over the long term. I know they had every intention of signing Jason Hayward as well, who ultimately signed for less money to go to Chicago rather than staying in St. Louis, but they had budgeted and prepared for it. They also did make the decision, and this is the case with Albert Pujols, they're not going to go beyond what they value a player as worth. And I think it's worked with Pujols. What's fascinating about Pujols is the idea is always short-term for long-term, right? So you're getting rid of Pujols and you miss out on the next couple of years, and that's going to really be painful. But the turnaround is over the long term. You don't want Pujols into his late 30s, early 40s. Well, in terms of the Cardinals, what ended up working out was it happened in the short term and the long term. One of the draft picks that they received in conjunction for letting Pujols go was, it turned out to be, Michael Wacha. And so Michael Wacha went out, and in 2013, you know, a year plus removed from being drafted by the Cardinals, Wacha went out and won the NLCS MVP. And so they never really paid a short-term price for the decision to move on from Pujols. There was certainly some negative reaction from the fans at the time that it happened, but it was pretty fast that you saw that turnaround, and that was very significant in terms of being able to help the Cardinals right away. So that ended up turning out to be a win-win scenario for them, it sure looks like.
And he hits me, and here goes one into left. How about three on the night in a row? A three-run shot, a two-run home run, and now a solo blast. And Albert Pujols has tied Reggie Jackson with three home runs against the Rangers in Game 3. Wow. That's a wow.
St. Louis isn't exactly Oakland, of course, but it isn't one of the premier markets. And in a league where there's no salary cap, what market you play in is a big factor, luxury tax or not. So do you think the Cardinals would be taking the same tactic if they were playing in Los Angeles, New York, Chicago, one of the big markets?
So the reason I do is that this goes to the heart of what Bill DeWitt Jr. sees as important in building a team and making sure that player development is really significant and an important base from which to build. And Bill tried to put those things into place from the moment he took over as owner and was trying to figure out how to do it. But his belief in that stems from, you know, being raised as Bill DeWitt Sr.'s son. And so Bill DeWitt Sr., of course, worked directly under Branch Rickey, helped develop a farm system with Rickey, was effectively Rickey's first farm director, and trained his son in these methods. Well, you saw his son have that belief in a farm system as early as when he was a graduate student at the Harvard Business School. And I was fascinated by this paper that Bill wrote in 1965 in a graduate class talking about the need to build base through the farm system, not just in sort of the superficial way that you hear a lot of people talk about such things in various sports, baseball included, but very specifically in how he did so. And so, for my mind, that is something that I think you would have seen Bill take anywhere he ultimately owned a team. You also sort of seen that borne out in that the largest market teams are trying to do this as well. That's the way the Mets have built. It's what the Yankees are trying very hard to do, and it's what the Dodgers have done over the last couple of years as well. So you're just seeing those methods now applied at the largest markets, but it's something that I think was integral to anything Bill was going to do.
another transition that was critical, this is in terms of manager, was from Hall of Famer Tony La Russa, who retired after winning the World Series in 2011, to Mike Matheny, who took over the very next season for his first managing gig. It was pretty much a seamless one. In Matheny's four seasons, the Cardinals have averaged 94 wins, been to the playoffs each year, and have made the NLCS, or made three NLCS appearances and went to the World Series in 2013. What has Mike Matheny done to prevent any sort of drop-off?
So, Matheny, and let's talk about briefly what it meant that they brought Matheny in, right? Matheny is not someone that anyone would say is an elite game manager. He's not tactically necessarily, you know, among the very top of his peers. What Matheny does, however, that is among the top of his peers, is his ability to communicate and manage people over a 162-game season. And that's a very big deal. That's something that is clearly more important to the St. Louis Cardinals. And I think the hope has been, I know the hope has been, the game managing skills would just continue to develop. But what matters is the way he's able to keep people motivated and playing hard throughout 162 games and into October. And so from that perspective, they made a choice, a tactical change. And it was interesting. It was John Mozeliak's first managerial hire, don't forget, because he inherited Tony when he took over as GM after the 2007 season. And it's just a fascinating thing to see because certainly, like you said, it's been a seamless transition. There are people who are going to be down on Matheny until he manages the Cardinals to a World Series victory. But frankly, I think it's real hard to look at the results that he's put up and think that it's been anything other than a massive success.
We certainly hear about Matheny and the great job he does. We, of course, hear about the players and their execution. And as you mentioned, John Mozeliak as GM gets a lot of credit. Bill DeWitt, of course, Lunau when he was the GM is also integral. But is there a person, Howard, who you would say, through what you learned, is kind of the unsung hero of the franchise's success?
It's really everything. It's really everyone you mentioned and more. But, you know, managers down at the minor league level who get an opportunity to take care of players and develop players as well. It really is start to finish an organization that puts a real emphasis on attention to detail. So even right down to, like, Ollie Marmol down, you know, in the low levels. Now he's in the Florida State League. At the time I was writing the book, he was managing the State College Spikes. There's an effort and an effort that pays off to bring in people who are able to properly develop talent, you know, in a way that George Tissell emphasized. There's a guy, I guess if I had to pick the most unsung of the many heroes, Steve Turco would be the one I'd pick. Steve Turco has been a coach with the St. Louis Cardinals after being a player in their minor league system going back to the late 1970s. He was a George Tissell guy, and now has been with the Cardinals for 35 years, or roughly half the tenure that George Tissell himself, you know, was with the Cardinals. And in Turco, a guy who they have, by the way, managing their Gulf Coast League team, which is very instructive. In other words, the Cardinals draft guys, they bring them in. The Gulf Coast League is usually for the younger of the prospects, you know, maybe international guys you sign. Who are you going to send them to first? They send them to Steve Turco. And that's not by accident. That's a guy who is beloved by his players, who has worked with so many Cardinals who have gone on to great things, and is continuing to do so, even though, you know, he's done it since he finished up playing in his mid-20s, and now he's, you know, around 60 years of age. And I think there's that continuity that goes along with that effort and attention to detail. I think those two things put together end up producing a lot of smaller heroes that you maybe don't hear about with the Cardinals that are part of the whole.
In the air to left, well hit. Back is Craig. What a team. What a ride. The Cardinals are world champs in 2011.
Yeah, other smaller heroes in terms of the players, and this is in great delight to the great fans in St. Louis and probably a great annoyance to the rival fans, are the players that seem to just come out of maybe sort of nowhere and perform in the postseason. I mean, I'm talking about, you know, Michael Wacha as a rookie in 2013, like Matt Carpenter, Colton Wong. I mean, guys that just you don't expect to be producing at high levels come through, and it seems like in the playoffs. Is there any way to explain why that happens so regularly?
Yeah, I mean, I think it dates back to the last answer, which is to say that what the Cardinals do is they manage to find, through attention to detail, ways to maximize what they have, right? So I remember when Wacha was dominating in the 2013 playoffs, you had all these people, and Wacha was a late first-round pick. So it seemed like just about every single team had a story written about them, like, why didn't the Padres have Michael Wacha? Why didn't the Mets draft Michael Wacha? You know, and so on and so forth. And the thing about it is, Wacha was a good prospect. And I remember talking to Dan Kantrowicz, who was the scouting director at the time, who talked about Wacha being at the top of his board. And so the fact that Wacha dropped down, he was able to get him. He thought, you know, well, gee, well, what are we missing? You know, and as it turned out, nothing was what they were missing, and Wacha was an elite talent. But that was only half of it. Once you get Wacha, then suddenly Wacha's in that system, and he's working with the Cardinals' pitching coaches. He's working with guys like Ace Adams, who's now with the Astros, who, you know, work really hard at things like tilt and making sure that you're on a downward plane with your pitches. And suddenly Wacha was able to sort of race through the system, and his fastball was more effective when he got to the major leagues than it was when they drafted him. And Wacha managed to take the fast track and become a dominant starter pretty fast. And it's disappointing to me to see some of the injuries he's had since, because he's such an interesting and intriguing talent. And of course, he's still so young. It'll be fascinating to see. But it's far from the only example. You know, Marco Gonzalez, the Cardinals drafted him late first round. You know, changeup was his carrying tool. But the idea was, look, we think we can shape up his three-pitch offering in order to become a major leaguer fast. I had one coach say, look, he's on the Wacha plan. And within a year after being drafted, you saw Marco Gonzalez up and contributing with the Cardinals as well. So these things don't happen by accident. They have these systems in place, and they're very careful and very detail-oriented. And Gary Larocque, who's director of player development, is on top of everything that's going on. Gary knows everything there is to know about every single player at any given time, and can recall him from memory. And that just filters down. And so you end up seeing Cardinals do well over and over again. And it's just funny for me to hear this idea that, you know, well, gee, it must be a series of coincidences. And of course, no success, sustained success ever is, and it certainly isn't in St. Louis.
With the Astros now under GM Jeff Luhnow, of course, has taken a Cardinal-like approach to their franchise, and we've seen it work out very well, especially last year after his 8 years in St. Louis. And just about every franchise is embracing or getting heavily involved in analytics to some degree. But are there any other teams that you notice, whether it's in Major League Baseball or perhaps in other sports, who are taking on an approach very similar to what the Cardinals are doing?
So it's really the way the baseball world as a whole is doing things now, right? And it comes down to a question of degrees. It comes down to a question of when did they start, and it comes down to what the balance is between the two. But that's what the Cardinals really did in a fundamental way, is they ushered in this idea that, look, the analytic reboot of the Oakland Athletics is not some sort of strange outlier that is inconsistent with the overall relationship between baseball teams and statistics. It said to the baseball world, if the Cardinals are doing this, that's the way the baseball world is going. And so even the Philadelphia Phillies, who were acknowledged to be the last out of the barn when it came to incorporating stats into what they're doing. Well, they went out and brought in a saber guy in Matt Klentak to be their GM. They are slowly but surely building an analytics operation, and they're the very last to do it. You know, in much the same way that Integration was pretty clearly going to be a significant part of baseball, but yet you saw a lag. You think of the Phillies and analytics as the Red Sox were to Pumpsy Green.
With regards to the scope of this book project, was the amount of access that you received from the Cardinals more or less than you originally anticipated?
Hard to say. It was possible to anticipate what ultimately happened, which is to say that every single member of that organization, from Bill DeWitt on down, answered every single question I had in every conceivable way. So, you know, you go in with the hopes and the best of intentions, and certainly, you know, that was a conversation I had with Bill, you know, at the start of it, that, look, you know, I need to be able to talk to everyone and see everything to be able to do this accurately. And so being able to do that start to finish, you know, led to, I think, a better process and a better result. But never in my journalistic career have I had the opportunity to have every single question answered. And that was what happened here. And it allowed for insights in an array of different ways.
The book, once again, is called The Cardinals Way. It comes out February 23rd. Howard, best of luck with the book, and thanks so much for your time.
Thank you. Terrific interview. I appreciate it.